offer my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. And dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai. As always, having the pleasure of talking to all of you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. As the name suggests, this is a series on which we study the Bhagavad Gita. And we go through every verse of the Bhagavad Gita. It's not a general talk or discussion on the Bhagavad Gita. It is not a discourse on the Bhagavad Gita, because as I've said many times before, I do not have the qualifications to be giving you a discourse on the Gita. But at the same time, this is indeed a study where together we study each verse, try to understand the meaning, go as deep as we can, and also constantly place it in context of what Swami has told us in his various discourses, in his discussions, and of course the Gita Vahini, and that's the effort which has been going on. This is the 27th week, 27th episode. We're still in the second chapter, but as we can see, there is so much to learn, so much to understand in each one of these verses. A casual glance at some of these verses may make it appear that there is some similarity of this. We've heard it before, and this has been mentioned before by Lord Krishna. He's repeating it. And of course, I've been saying that so many times that this is a repetition of what Krishna said in that place. But we can see that each verse has been worded in a certain manner that it gives us a fresh perspective. Not only a perspective, but a clue or a hint as to how we can practice this in our everyday life. And I think that is the experience it has been for me, going through these verses with all of you, and I'm ever so grateful to all of you for this opportunity that you're all joining me on this journey. And because you're all there, I'm more diligent in going through whatever I'm doing as part of the series. So thanks to all of you, and I join all of you in expressing our gratitude to Swami, because without his love and grace, I don't think this would be possible. As always, let's begin with a brief introduction of what we covered in the episode last week. We covered only two verses last week, 55 and 56 of the second chapter. Prior to that, the week concluded with Arjuna asking this question about the Stita Prajna. He says, can you give me a description of the Stita Prajna? How does he walk? How does he sit? How does he move about? That is the question that Arjuna asks, and we had mentioned then that it was not that Arjuna was curious to know the physical attributes or traits of a Stita Prajna, but he wanted to know the nature of a Stita Prajna, and with the understanding that the nature expresses in traits, and with the understanding that by following the traits, we too can develop that nature. That is the idea with which Arjuna asks that question. And understanding the import of the question, Krishna gives an answer which is not a description of his physical traits, but starts off with a very fundamental definition of who a Stita Prajna is. And verse number 55 is that fundamental description or definition of a Stita Prajna. He says that a Stita Prajna is one who gives up the desires as and when they occur in the mind. Right, that is one of the first definitions. There's a two-part definition that he gives. The first one he says is he discards the desires or gives up the desires as and when they occur in the mind. And then he says, Atmani eva atmana tushtah. He remains satisfied in himself. He does not seek bliss or happiness which is outside, but he finds that within himself. Then we went on to discuss how these two points are like the negative and positive approach that are involved in achieving a certain target. And that was based on what Swami says in the Gita Vahini, where Swami says one is like the weeding process. The idea of removing the desires as and when they occur in the mind is like the weeding process, and that is the negative process. And the positive one is implanting of true happiness, the happiness which is within each one of us. In fact, in that portion of the Gita Vahini, Swami says that the positive process also is the development of attachment to God. I didn't go much into that because in the context of the Gita, that aspect comes later. So I thought we'll do that when that happens. But this is what Swami says with regards to verse number 55. And then we also went on to see how even where Swami explained that even if we were to concentrate on removing the desires, this idea of being satisfied in oneself will begin to express itself, because that is our innate nature. We are complete innately. Purnamidam, Swami would say that we are complete by nature. And we also have that bliss within. That is the nature. That is the swabhava of each one of us, right? So even as we remove this desire to crave for objects outside, this desire to have something, possess something, when this is removed, that state of bliss within remains perfect, right? So that's the discussion we had with regards to verse number 55. Verse 56, Krishna now slowly begins to expound on that basic definition that he gives. He says that the sthita prajna does not get destabilized, or his mind does not get agitated when faced with sorrow or when faced with disappointment. And we saw how that is a very, very important description, because a straight opposite of that, or a straight contrast of that, is the nature of a worldly person, is the nature of you and me, if I could say that, right? At least of me. By nature, we are all like that. When we do not get what we want, when we do not, we are not able to achieve what we have set our eyes upon, that disappointment destabilizes our mind. And Swami was saying that the sthita prajna is one who does not get destabilized when faced with sorrow. And the other nature is that he does not crave for pleasures, right? What does crave mean here? It means that longing for experiencing that pleasure dictates one's choices and actions. That does not happen in the case of a sthita prajna, because he has given up craving for pleasure, and because that nature has been attained, because he has now given up the craving for pleasures, the sthita prajna also gives up the offsprings of the cravings, which are attachment, fear, and anger. And I think we went through in detail how all of these are connected. And as I mentioned, this connection is going to be mentioned again by Lord Krishna. We will be discussing in detail about that when that shloka comes by too. But that is the very beautiful description he gives, that it is not that a sthita prajna does not enjoy when pleasure comes the way, or does not feel sorrow when it comes its way, but it does not destabilize one. He does not get elated, he does not get totally depressed, and let that depression or that elation or that craving for that elation decide how he discriminates, right? That is one of the very, very important characteristics. So how can we practice the traits of a sthita prajna? Because that is what is Arjuna's inner motive in asking that question. Can we stabilize the mind when in sorrow? And it is a very, very possible thing. It is not outlandish. Each one of us with effort can get to that point where we remain calm when we are elated, when we remain calm when we are faced with sorrow or disappointment, right? So that is the very beautiful explanation that Krishna gives. And of course, we concluded last week by speaking about a few things, a few very practical points that Swami gives with regards to how to overcome one's desires, right? So that's what we stopped with. Well, if you're asking, oh, and that's something I want to know, what did Swami say? Please go to last week's episode. You can download that. And right in the end of that episode, we discussed about that. But of course, you can otherwise go to Swami's Gita Vahini, and it is written in detail there. You can read it in Swami's own words. We'll progress with the verses that we have for this week. We will begin with verse number 57. Hopefully, we'll be able to cover three verses this week, unlike last week. Again, when I read out the meaning of this verse after I play the rendition by Brother Shyam, you might wonder that this is a repetition, and that is why going into each one of those words will give us so much more in-depth meaning, and not only meaning but hints as to how we can start practicing some of these things, because at the end of the day, we should be able to apply these in our day-to-day life, right? Philosophy otherwise is only for the discussion rooms or debates, and it's of not much use. It has to be applicable to our day-to-day life. And, you know, that is why the setup of the whole Bhagavad Gita, here is Krishna. Krishna is considered to be a kingmaker, right? He's deeply into politics, if I could say that, because he's, making one a king, he's pulling down somebody, and he's setting up these alliances between kings and kingdoms. So in that sense, he's a very active personality in the political arena of those days. And who is he speaking to? He's speaking to a prince. He's speaking to a warrior. And what is he speaking about? He's speaking about action, right? So all of this is practical. And if we go through the Gita without taking practical tips from it, I think we are missing out something. And even if we can take 10% of what is being said, and if that can be applied, I think that would make a huge difference to our life, and I think that should be our endeavor, that should be our perspective, even as we go through these verses. So, with that brief introduction, we'll go to verse number 57 of chapter 2. As I said, very beautifully and clearly rendered by one of our alumnus, Brother Shyam. We'll listen to it. I'll give you a brief meaning after that, and then we'll discuss it in detail.
यः सर्वत्र नभिस्नेहः तत्तत्प्राप्य शुभाशुभम् नाभिनन्दति न द्वेष्टि तस्य प्रज्ञा प्रतिष्ठिता.
He who has no attachment to anything and who neither rejoices nor hates on getting this or that, good or bad, his intellect is properly stabilized. As I mentioned even last week, some of the descriptions that Lord Krishna gave of the Sthita Prajna, this verse in that sense is a re-summary or a re-description of the Sthita Prajna. And again, it is about the approach of the Sthita Prajna and not his physical traits or his attributes. Krishna says here, Yaha, the one who, sarvatra, in all situations, anabhisnehaha, is unattached. So he who is unattached in all kinds of situations, he says. And this word, anabhisnehaha, is a very, very interesting word, and I think we should spend a little time on this. I think when I translate this word as being unattached or having no attachments, the moment you say that to a person, you should not be attached, it seems a little lofty in our mind, and that's a little difficult for me to achieve. But if you look at the word sneha, it's a common word. I think we use it in most of the Indian languages. Sneha means friendliness, affection, love, right? That's the word sneha. But very interestingly, the word sneha in Sanskrit has another meaning. And this word, anabhisnehaha, uses that meaning of the word sneha as its root. And the meaning of the word sneha, the other meaning of the word is stickiness or being greasy, right? The moment you say stickiness or greasy, something which, gets stuck to your fingers when you're using it, or it gets stuck to a surface, right? So sneha also means stickiness. So in this context, anabhisneha, it uses that meaning. So abhisneha, anabhisneha is the antonym of the word abhisneha. What is the meaning of abhisneha? It means liking something or someone so much that you get stuck to it, that you get attached to it, right? It becomes very difficult to let go. It is not wrong to have sneha. Sneha is affection. Sneha is friendliness. But it becomes bad to have abhisneha. That becomes attachment, right? And that's why the usage of the word sneha is so brilliant, and, the brilliance of the language of Sanskrit itself comes forth in this single usage itself, isn't it? And I think there's a very, very thin line between what we refer to as affection and attachment. And that is why a common word is being used here. Affection nourishes, but attachment can become a hurdle, right? When you have affection or sneha, you will care for the person that you have sneha towards. But when it becomes abhisneha, firstly, you will get so involved with that person that his or her pain will become yours. And you will end up being miserable, and you will make up you will end up making that person's life miserable too. And that's the danger of abhisneha. And when attachment comes into play, even if it is a person, even if it is a member of your family, a friend or a spouse, the moment attachment comes into play, we become possessive of that person. In other words, we start possessing that person like an object, like how we possess an object. I have a mobile phone, I say this is my phone. I have a watch, I say this is my watch. I say this person is mine. We start possessing the other person like an object when we get attached to that person. And what happens when I begin to possess something or someone? I get attached to it. How does it pan out? When we, what we've been saying in the past few weeks, this is nothing new. When I get attached to something, what I do in a sense is I place the switch for making me sad or happy in that object or person outside me, right? That is what happens when I get attached to something. Let's say I have a beautiful brand new sparkling car and obviously I'll be attached to it, right? Or anybody, you've got a very expensive car, you get very attached to it. When I say I get attached to an object like this car, I place a part of my heart on that object, right? So I'm driving on the traffic and somebody comes close enough to scratch my car. What happens? My heart skips a beat, right? Because I've placed my heart on that object. That is what happens, isn't it? Like that, when we put our heart on a number of things and a number of people as we do in our life, that's what happens when we get attached to multiple things. We have placed our hearts in multiple places, and every time something happens to any of those objects or any of those people, my heart starts skipping a beat. So which means I will never be at peace. But then the question comes, how can we live without this kind of empathy or affection? Isn't affection right? Isn't affection good? Isn't compassion good? Right? How can we live in a society? Otherwise we will be like a bunch of furniture in the room, right? We cannot live like that. Isn't compassion good? That's the question that comes to our life, comes to mind. Shouldn't a wife care for the husband? Shouldn't a mother care for the child? Shouldn't a son care for the mother? These are all things which constitute a cultured society. How can we say that affection is bad? Or how do we ensure that affection does not turn to attachment, or we do not give up affection in the name of giving up attachment, right? That's the question which should legitimately come in our minds. There's a very beautiful way we can explain this, the difference between affection and attachment. I read this in a book and I thought it's very, very beautifully explained, and I'll share it with all of you in this context. Now, when I have a cut in my body, let's say in my toe, or even better, on some part of the body which I cannot directly see, on my back or back of my elbow or some part like that, what happens when there is a cut or a small piercing pain somewhere? Immediately, the pain draws my mind to that point of the body, right? That's what immediately happens. My attention is drawn to that part of the body. Why does that happen? Because I'm supposed to attend to that wound at that moment in time. I either dress it up or I wash it or I, you know, put a band-aid over it. I am supposed to attend to that portion of my body. That is the whole idea of pain and the response in the mind to pain, right? So at that moment, I am supposed to act drawn by that pain. This is very similar to affection or sneha. This is what we are supposed to do for each other. When I see a dear one in pain, when I see a person who's, you know, sitting next to me, or who's a good friend of mine, or somebody in my family in pain, my mind and attention is meant to be drawn towards that person's pain so that I can act in a manner to assuage that person's pain. But if I'm a person with, talking about pain, physical pain, let's say I'm a person with very, very low pain threshold. A little pain and I will not be able to think of anything else, right? That's what will happen. If I go crazy with a little bit of pain, I just will not be able to think of anything else. All my mind will be drawn to that point of pain. And that is the difference between affection and attachment, sneha and abhisneha. Sneha is also operating based on pain. Both are operating based on pain, right? Affection also operates based on pain. There is a normal state of my body and there is this state of me having pain. when this transition from normal to pain happens, my mind is woken up to that pain, right? I don't think of my little toe all the time. But if I stamp on something or I kick a rock and my toe starts hurting, then I start thinking of my toe. Then my mind is drawn to that point, right? But then I attend to it. I probably, you know, put some ointment or whatever I'm supposed to do. And then I get on with my life. I am supposed to act that response to pain so that I attend to that, not so that I completely concentrate only on that and forget everything else. But if I'm attached to that, I'm so attached to that normal pain-free state, when I'm in pain, I just cannot think straight. I will feel that the whole world is crumbling, isn't it? And that's what happens when we are attached to some person and something happens to that person. We completely lose control over ourselves. And that is what we came across in the verse that we covered last week. Krishna says, "Sthita Prajna does not completely lose his balance when faced with pain or disappointment," right? But when we are in that state of attachment, when something, we have placed all our heart on something which is outside of us, something happens to it, instead of in a mature manner handling it, doing whatever we can, we start losing our balance and then we'll curse God and we'll say that, oh, everybody has let me down and it's not worth living, right? That is abhisneha, and that is bad. Similarly, when someone dear to you is in pain, you know, they need your attention. That is where empathy and compassion and all of that comes into play. It's very, very important. But if seeing their pain, I start wailing more than that person himself or herself, I will make my life miserable. I will make that person's, I'll add to that person's misery, and I will become a burden, and I will become a burden for, I mean, the pain will become a burden for me, and I will become a burden for that person, right? That is why affection and care is good, but attachment becomes a burden. Sneha is good, abhisneha is dangerous. So Krishna describes that the sthita prajna is anabhisneha. He does not have any form of abhisneha or attachment or stickiness to that state of being pleasant or being pain-free. So he goes on to say, yaha sarvatra anabhisneha. He is unattached in all situations. And then he goes on to say, tat tat prapya. Whatever comes his way, shubha, ashubham, be it pleasant or unpleasant, na abhinandati, na dveshti. Right? Very, very beautifully worded. He says, tat tat prapya. Whatever comes his way, shubha, ashubham, be it pleasant or unpleasant, na abhinandati, na dveshti. Abhinandati means to welcome or rejoice when something occurs. Dveshti means to hate or loathe, that you don't want something to happen. So be it shubham or ashubham, that is pleasant or unpleasant. Shubham, ashubham actually means auspicious and inauspicious. But if you look at it, what do we call as inauspicious? What is unpleasant to us is only inauspicious, right? That is what we label as inauspicious. We don't like death, so death becomes inauspicious. We don't like accidents and pain, because that is termed as inauspicious. So when he says shubham and ashubham, it means auspicious, inauspicious, as well as pleasant and unpleasant. Right? So he goes on to say, so be it shubham or ashubham, the sthita prajna does not welcome it, nor does he loathe it. Na abhinandati, na dveshti. And Krishna concludes that shloka by saying, tasya prajna pratishtita. Such a person's knowledge is fixed and well established. And that is a very, very important point that is being repeated again and again, right? Why should we be dispassionate like that? Why should pain and joy not affect me? Why should I be equanimous? Because as we've discussed a couple of weeks back, it is like the lamp which is in the middle of the house. The breeze is blowing from all sides. The moment I close all the doors and windows or put a protective shade around this lamp that is in the middle of the house, the flame automatically becomes stable. I don't have to go and straighten the lamp through any special technique or process. I only have to take care that the breeze does not disturb the flame, right? So the reason why I should not get attached is so that I don't let events outside disturb my discrimination, disturb my wisdom, right? My discrimination will be steady, prajna pratishtita. This knowledge of prajna will be steady, and when I ensure that these kind of changes around me don't affect me, right? And that is when he becomes a Stitha Prajna. And if you look at it, it's not a very, very difficult thing if you come to think of it, though it might appear that, oh, you should be unattached, you should be beyond the body, you should be beyond pain. It just needs mental training. If you look at it, it just needs mental training. As I said, we have to learn when to leave the windows open, right? It's not that we should completely shut ourselves. We only have to learn when to leave the windows open and when to close them. And the windows, as we have mentioned, are the senses. And in fact, in the next shloka, Krishna is going to make that very point. How do you go about this with a sense of balance, right? We'll discuss that in the next verse, which is verse number 54. Listen to the verse. I'll give you a short meaning of that, and then we'll discuss that in detail.
Yada samharate chayam kurmongani vasarvashaha indriyani indriyarthebhyah tasya prajna pratishthita.
When he withdraws all his sense organs from sense objects, just as a tortoise does to all of its own limbs, then he is declared to be a man of stable intellect. As we can see, this verse also ends with tasya prajna pratishtita. His wisdom or knowledge is steady and stable. Till now, Krishna was telling about one's attitude. His mental state should be such, this response should be such. Now slowly Krishna speaks about the methodology of how to get there, right? And that's why it's a very, very important verse. He says, yada cha ayam. And when this person, samharate, withdraws, sarvashaha, completely, kurmaha angani iva, like the tortoise withdraws its limbs, kurmoho angani iva, like the tortoise withdraws its limbs. We've seen how a tortoise can completely pull itself into the shell, right? And that's one of the standout features of a tortoise. Right? That's why when we're children, we always spoken of as the tortoise as having this special skill of having the shell and having the ability to completely pull itself. But what is Krishna saying? The Stitha Prajna withdraws. A tortoise withdraws its limbs. But what does a Stitha Prajna withdraw? He says, Indriyani Indriya Arthebhyaha. The Indriyas, which are the senses, Indriya Arthaha, are the sense objects. So Krishna says, a Stitha Prajna withdraws the senses from the sense objects. Indriyani Indriya Arthebhyaha. Like a tortoise. This analogy of a tortoise is very, very poignant, right? So when Krishna says, withdraw your senses like the tortoise, withdraws its limbs, are we suggesting that a tortoise with his limbs completely withdrawn is in some way better than a tortoise whose head and limbs are out? Is that what we are suggesting? If that is the case, we might then ask, why on earth should you give a tortoise limbs if its limbs withdrawn is better than its limbs put outside? And in a similar manner, if I am supposed to withdraw all my senses from the sense objects, why should God give me senses at all in the first place? Right? That's the question which comes up. That is why it is very, very important to always keep in mind the context of the Bhagavad Gita. What is the essence of the Gita? Mama dharma. I am supposed to do my duty. What is Krishna trying to achieve through all this discourse that he is giving? He is trying to get Arjuna to do his duty. Yes, to do one's duty plays a very, very important role in the spiritual journey, and that is what Krishna is trying to teach us through this entire discourse, right? But at the end of the day, the Gita was taught so that Arjuna will do his duty. The whole idea is of whatever we do in the spiritual path is spiritual enlightenment. But for that spiritual enlightenment, doing one's duty is important. And Krishna is giving this discourse primarily so that Arjuna will be enlightened enough to do his duty before he attains the ultimate enlightenment, right? So the whole context of this is about doing one's duty, leading a good life and doing what one is supposed to do. So why has the tortoise been given limbs, if you were to look at that? Why has it been given the mechanism to withdraw into a shell? Why has the creature been made like that? The limbs, like for all other creatures, are meant for locomotion. Right? The head of the tortoise has eyes and it has ears and nose. So all of this is given so that the tortoise can go around its life, and let us say the purpose of the tortoise life is to keep itself alive, right? That's the purpose of every creature. It tries to live as long as it possibly can, right? So the purpose of all of these limbs that has been given to this creature is so that it can move around, it can find its food, and you know, it can move from one place to the other, and it can mate and procreate and whatever it is. So all of these limbs have been given for all of that purposes. But why has the tortoise been given the shell? Of course, I'm not going to claim that I know exactly what is God's plan when he gave the shell to the tortoise, but look at it this way, that if you look at different animals, each animal has been given a mechanism for self-defense, right? A deer has been given very swift feet, like a rabbit also has been given very swift feet. There are some creatures which have been given fangs. A creature like the skunk has been given some kind of obnoxious chemical that it can spray out in self-defense. In the case of the tortoise, it has been given this mechanism of self-defense where it can draw itself completely into the shell and it cannot be affected, right? Why has it been given this particular mechanism? One of the reasons is because probably the tortoise is a very slow animal. It has not been given the ability to move fast from a place of danger, so it has been given the special ability to withdraw itself completely inside the senses, right? So when we look at it from that point of view, it must use its head and limbs to navigate around and find its food and keep itself alive. But when it is in danger or when its life is endangered, it must withdraw these things into itself. Similarly, this body with all the sense organs has been given to us to perform our duty. Right now, if you look at it, I'm performing my duty, right? Doing the show and speaking to all of you through the radio is part of the duty that I have taken upon myself or has been entrusted to me. So for performing this duty, I'm certainly using my eyes to read my notes here, and all the time I'm looking at the monitors in front of me to check whether the streaming is happening properly. I'm right now wearing a headphone. I'm constantly listening to the volume of the audio to ensure that it is going out fine. So I'm using all of my senses to perform the duty that I am supposed to do, right? Now, if I say that, oh, the senses have to be withdrawn from the sense object, so I'm going to close my eyes and I'm going to shut my ear and I'm going to speak, there is a possibility that I might not be doing my duty properly, right? I might not be, something might go wrong and I might not notice it, right? So the senses have to be used. There is no doubt about that. But they have to be used when it comes to performing one's duty. And when should the senses be withdrawn? Just like how the limbs have been given to the tortoise to keep itself alive, and it withdraws the limbs when its life is endangered, the senses have to be used for me to do my duty, and I have to withdraw my senses when the distraction caused by the sense objects can endanger my duty, right? That is the bottom line of how and when to use the senses, as this beautiful shloka explains. Let us say tomorrow after listening to the program, you come and tell me, yesterday your program was complete bunkum, it made no sense. At that time, how do I use my senses? Do I flare up? Do I go into a rage, or do I get depressed? Oh my God, I'm useless, I'm not able to do. Or let's say I ask you very calmly that, you know, oh, really sorry to hear that. Can you please tell me specifically what was wrong so that I can correct myself? So if that person gives me any more feedback, I'm going to listen to it through my ears. I am accepting it through my senses. Why am I doing that? To perform my duty better. So I'm using my senses to enhance my ability to do my duty, right? But in the conversation, I figure out that person is criticizing for the sake of criticizing, or, you know, he's not heard the program at all and he's simply saying something. Am I able to completely withdraw from that and say that, okay, this criticism does not mean anything to me and I should not take it to heart, right? That is what it means by completely withdrawing my senses. So constantly using the senses when performing our duty or when you're doing what you're supposed to do, but withdrawing the senses every time the sense objects can begin to distract me from what I'm supposed to do or what my duty is. So certainly the senses have to be used, but when they can distract me from my duty or from my discrimination, I must have that consciousness to withdraw, right? But how is this done, right? That's the next question. Let's say I'm walking on the road and the scene on the road is distracting me. I certainly cannot close my eyes and start walking. I say, oh, all of these funny posters are there and all these funny scenes are there. I don't want to see. I can't close my eyes and walk. That will be a bigger disaster for me and people around me, right? So what does it mean when we say withdraw the senses from the sense objects? Swami very, very clearly explains what are the indriyas. When we say senses, indriyas, the eyes, the nose, the ears, and all of these are sense organs. And when we say organs, they are part of the body. They are not the senses. They are sense organs which are still part of the bodies. So what are the indriyas or the senses? Swami says, the eyes and the mind, the ears and the mind, the tongue and the mind, the skin and the mind. So it is the mind that backs these senses together. This combination of the mind and the sense organs is what is referred to as the indriyas. For example, there are some different kind of food items. Some food items might have a smell which is repulsive to me, but you might find that smell very, very attractive, right? That there are so many food items like that. I don't want to mention any of them with the risk of me sounding like that is an example of a food item which is bad or unsavory. But there are many food items like that which have a foul smell, and that is probably what is special about that food item, right? If the senses alone are the deciding factor, then there should be some commonality. The very fact that there is some smell which I find repulsive, which you find tasty, it means that it is in the mind that smell has a certain role, right? And similarly, like, we all have a lot of love for Swami, but I can bet that not many of us can love the kind of food that Swami ate, the kind of spice that Swami ate. It is, how much of a love you have for Swami, you cannot have love for that spice, right? Because Swami comes from Rayalaseema and his taste is completely different. So if the tongue itself is the deciding factor, then the tongue will only say that this is spicy, this is not spicy. How do we say that this is spicy and I like it? This food is more salty and I like it. This food is bland and I like it. It is always the mind which comes into the picture, right? The senses only carry the sensation, but it is the mind that decides if something is good or bad, pleasant or unpleasant. And how does the mind decide? By the way the mind is cultured, right? That is what the whole thing is. If my mind has been cultured to eat this kind of food, I find that kind of food tasty. And all of, when Swami says withdraw the sense organs from the sense objects, it is all a process of training the mind, right? I was once seeing this very, very interesting science program on pain, right? The program was on pain. And in that there was this very interesting conversation between a commando, who's an ex-commando from the army. And he was speaking about how they deal with pain. And he was giving an example where, let us say that he is unarmed, he does not have any weapons on him, and he has to have a combat with an assailant who comes with, say, a dagger or a knife, right? So that person has a sharp object which can hurt him, but he is unarmed. But he is in a situation that he has to go and have a duel with him, right? Now, he was talking about the situation. He's saying that generally we would avoid getting into any confrontation where we would get cuts on our body, because any cuts on the body means pain, and our mind has been programmed in such a manner that we avoid pain as much as possible, right? But then that commander was saying that this is a situation I have to take on. I have to battle with this man. Now, if you look at it, he said, you know, in the arms, there are some places where it is okay for me to get a cut. You were saying that if that person cuts on certain places, it'll only be a flesh wound, and that can be dealt with. But there are some times when you cut and you might end up cutting a very important vein, and that could lead to a more dangerous situation. Either he could bleed to death or he could, you know, lose his energy faster. So he was saying that the mind only knows pain. The mind will look at any cut as pain. It is going to hurt, so it is bad. Avoid. But you have to train the mind to understand that some cuts are okay, but some cuts are bad. So he was saying that how they, as commandos, go through that training. They have these specialized objects which are like tasers or electrical equipment which kind of imitate a cut from a knife. So he is saying that we practice in such a manner that some places when that taser is drawn on the flesh or the muscle or something, the mind is trained to think that this is okay. So when you go and fight with an armed assailant in that manner, you are ready to take some cuts on your body because that helps you overpower that person and then unarm him and, you know, put him down, pin him down, or whatever that is, right? So he was saying all of this is a process of training the mind to say that this pain is good, or you can't say pain is good, this pain is all right, this pain is tolerable, but this pain is bad, right? To train that mind, they go through this process, right? So when Swami says that the mind has to be withdrawn, or the senses or the indriyas has to be withdrawn, it is not that the eyes will stop seeing or the ears will stop listening. The mind's response to that particular input from the sense organ will be modulated or moderated by the intellect. That is what it means. Let us say I'm an officer in the government and someone offers me a bribe to do something which I should not do otherwise. Now my sense organs immediately, you know, my eyes look at this bundle of currency in front of me, which this person gives me as a form of bribe. When I generally look at money, what is my mind's thinking of money? Money is something which helps me lead a comfortable life. It helps me buy some conveniences in my life, right? And that is all the mind looks at it. And that's the whole process of, you know, why do we go and work and earn money and all of that. But when a bribe is offered, when this bundle of currency is placed in front of me with the name that this is a bribe I'm giving you to get something done from you, the senses will not see that money as anything else. The senses will only see that money as money and it will convey it to the brain, right? But I will have to train my mind to see that money along with the nature of that particular transaction, right? The eye itself cannot differentiate the money as this is the money that is earned from salary and this is the money that is coming as a bribe, but the mind will know it. And I should train the mind to ensure that this is the nature of the money and I should avoid this. Why? Going back to that, because it is distracting me from my duty, right? So the mind should be trained to reject anything that tends to distract me from my discrimination, from my duty, or from my moral living, right? So when we say withdraw, indriyani indriya arthebhyah, the senses have to be withdrawn from the sense objects, it means the sense object alone should not decide if that is good or bad, right? It is money, so it is good. Then it's only the sense organs which are operating. It is comfort, so it is good. It is pain, so it is bad. It is not in that manner that we should operate. The sense object, indriya artha, does not decide my discrimination or my choice making. But my intellect should decide whether that particular sense object has to be pursued or it has to be rejected, right? So this is the whole idea of what Krishna is saying, that you have to withdraw. So the discrimination must decide that. And when we talk about the case of a stitta prajna, this mechanism which we've been talking about of, you know, the sense objects not distracting and the sense organs or the senses being withdrawn into the mind, in the case of a stitta prajna, this whole mechanism is perfect. It is so perfect that Krishna says, like how a tortoise can completely withdraw its limbs, the stitta prajna knows when to use his senses and how to use them and when to ignore the inputs of the senses completely. So these two are complementary. what we refer to as a steady discrimination and not being affected by the input from the senses, right? And that is why both of these have been coming as pairs. You know, Krishna says this together, that his intellect is steady and he does not get distracted. His intellect is steady, he does not get troubled by pain. His intellect is steady and he does not get elated by pleasures. So these two are complementary, and that is why this whole description of, you know, how you control your sense organs and how you're supposed to operate with the sense organs. Because by practicing this, you automatically develop that. By closing the windows, the flame automatically becomes steady. So we'll go to the next verse, verse number 59. Again, another interesting verse. We'll listen to the verse. I'll give you a short translation after that, and then we'll talk about it in detail.
Vishaya vinivartante niraharasya dehinah rasavarjam rasopyasya parandrishtva nivartate.
For one who does not feed the senses come back to oneself, leaving the longing behind. Having seen Brahman, even the longing goes away. A very beautiful verse, and Krishna is taking this entire discussion to a level higher than whatever has been told now. A part of the verse is in fact a continuation of what Krishna was saying in the previous verse. The nature of the senses are to go outward, right? That is something that we have to keep in mind. Why? Because the senses or the sense organs are meant to be probes or measuring instruments, right, that help us navigate through this world. Some would use the word, you would say that the senses are referred to as matraha, or the measuring instruments. So every time the eyes see something pleasant, all that they do is they just report it to the mind. And then the mind follows it, right? And that's how we go outward. So when we say the senses are going astray, it is always this combination of the mind and the sense organ going outward. But the nature of the sense organs itself is to constantly keep going outward, so that, you know, they are like the probe which helps us get a sense of what is around us and what is happening around us. Swami would give this very, very beautiful analogy, and I'm sure we must have mentioned it in some of the other shows that we do. Swami says, imagine a scene where a mother and her child is going out into the marketplace, something like a village fair or something of that sort. Now, when a scene like that is very, very attractive and colorful to the child, so the child is walking down the road with the mother, and everything that is colorful and looks tasty and inviting, the child would start running towards it. It sees bright pink cotton candy, it starts running towards it, and it sees somebody else making some, bubble gums or chewing gums or whatever that is, and the child starts running towards it. The child starts looking at all of these things which looks inviting to it, and it craves and wants all of it, right? Anything that's colorful and anything that looks interesting, probably cool drinks or whatever it is. If the mother now stops at every point that the child says, I want this, and starts obliging, Swami says, the kid will not be able to discriminate what is right and wrong. The kid will simply eat whatever you give that child. And eventually what happens? The child falls sick, right? Swami says, similarly, when you constantly keep obliging the indriyas or the senses, as a result, it'll only result in roga or disease. The disease of the body, right? The sense organs at the end of the day is part of the body. When you start indulging them constantly, there is sickness of the body. And of course, Swami says there is a sickness of the mind too, which probably will come in a later point in the Bhagavad Gita itself. So Swami gives this analogy of the mother does not stop at every place and oblige the child. But what does the mother do? The mother will probably tell, hey, don't go after that. I know, I will not give you this. Or after a certain point, Swami would say that the mother just keeps walking. So the child sees that the mother is not, and the child does not have the attention of the mother anymore. You know, you can just picturize that scene. The child probably will stop there and make a scene and he'll cry, and, you know, it's a very dramatic child. It might even roar on the ground and try to create a scene there. But the mother just keeps walking. So after a point that the child says that there is no point, this is not working, So the child just gets up, dusts itself, and goes and joins the mother. And the beauty of a child, the innocence of children is that they will completely forget that. They will not remember that, oh my God, few days back I went and the mother did not give me this sweet in the marketplace. No, the child will just forget that. It'll just take a few minutes walking down that same road with the mother and the child completely forgets that, right? And that is precisely what Krishna is explaining here, in especially the first line. He says, Vishaya. Vishaya means objects or the sense objects, but in this particular case, it is used as the senses itself, because there's a very semantic explanation of why Vishaya stands for the senses itself. I'm not going into that, but let's take the meaning to be the word, meaning for the word Vishaya to be the senses. He says the Vishaya, the senses, Niraharasya Dehinaha, means the embodied person who refuses to feed the senses. Niraharasya Dehinaha, the embodied person or the individual who refuses to feed the Vishaya or the senses. He says, Vishaya Vinivartante, the senses return or recoil back, right? That's the typical analogy which Swami gave. When you don't oblige the senses, when you don't get the senses whatever it wants, after a period of time, the senses automatically fall in place. They recoil, they return to where they belong. So if I lead an austere life, it could be by choice, it could be by force, right? When I say by force, it could be poverty that is making me lead an austere life, or I could be a millionaire and I could have 100 health problems in my body which is making me lead an austere life, right? There are a lot of people who say this. They earn all through their life and by the time they go past their prime, they get all kinds of, they've earned so much money, they've got the most comfortable bed in their bedroom, they've got a beautiful and expensive air conditioner, they've made all of that, and finally they get health problems, they go to the doctor, and what does the doctor say? You know, your back is bad, so you have to sleep on the floor, AC is not good for you because you're having this lung problem and all of that, and finally he starts living life like a poor man. So we could lead an austere life by choice, by saying that no, this is simple living is important for a spiritual life, or the circumstances of poverty or health issues might ensure that, or maybe ensuring that I'm leading an austere life. So even in these conditions, in a sense, I am able to withdraw my indriyas or the sense organs. I am choosing not to be carried away by it, right? Let's say I see a very expensive watch. I know I can't afford it, so I will not simply keep thinking about it, right? It's a maturity. It does not require any kind of spiritual understanding. I'm not able to afford this. Why am I going to constantly keep thinking about it and keep feeling miserable? So I'll just look at it, probably crave for a few minutes, and I say, okay, this is beyond me, and I leave it, right? Or the other example I was giving of health problems, right? It's not that a diabetic patient does not crave for sweets. But after a certain point, he says that, no, this is not right for me, so why keep thinking about it, right? So we develop a certain amount of self-control, and eventually the mind will reconcile and stop craving for that particular object or for that particular convenience. Just like how we saw the child returns to the mother after doing all the melodrama and minds the mother's ignorance, right? So Krishna is saying you can practice refrain from sense objects through this kind of mental disciplining. And if you look at it, we all do that, and we are already doing that to a great extent, right? In some form or the other, I wouldn't agree with the fact that any of us don't do any kind of sense control at all. You cannot lead a life, a dignified life in society, if you're not having some kind of sense control, where you say that this is unaffordable to me, or this I cannot afford to eat this, or I cannot keep staring at a person like this, right? Some kind of sense control we do practice in everyday life. Let us say today I don't crave for an expensive object because I cannot afford it. But there is a possibility that tomorrow I get a little more money, and that expensive object now becomes slightly more affordable to me. it's not completely affordable, but it's a little more in my reaching distance than it was, say, a couple of months ago. So wouldn't this craving now again come back to life? Yes, I've controlled my craving. Yes, I've matured enough in my mind to withdraw myself from constantly thinking about it. And as Krishna said, you know, Vishaya Vinivartante, we recoil from the sense objects and the senses come back. But it does not make me future proof. The next time when it comes into grabbing distance, again that craving wakes up, right? And this happens in life many, many times, isn't it? We think that we have come over some desire, we think that we have come over some craving, but later in life it suddenly springs to life. Why does that happen? Because we have intellectually managed our mind till that point, which is a very good thing, which is a very good form of disciplining, and Krishna is encouraging that to a certain extent, as we can see here. And Swami also says that we should develop that kind of mental disciplining, right? But the taste for the objects, or that convenience, or that comfort, for those sense objects, that rasa, as they say in Sanskrit, that will not vanish. The taste for those things will not vanish. And that's why Krishna says in this verse that when he's talking about the sthita prajna, as we will see what is the precondition he says for that, but he says in this particular verse that even that rasa will vanish when a certain thing happens. He goes on to say, rasa varjam gives up the craving, rasaha api nivartate. He gives up the craving, rasa varjam, rasaha api nivartate. The taste itself is removed. The rasa or that taste for that object. You have controlled the craving, but the taste still remains. But he says, rasa varjam, the craving has been controlled, has been given up. Rasa api nivartate, the taste itself is given up or removed. For whom? Asya param drishtva. For he who has had the vision of the highest. Param drishtva, he who has seen the highest. Right? So all this disciplining that we're talking about, starving of the senses, marshalling of the senses, training the mind to see samatvam in pain and pleasure, pleasant and unpleasant things, and this is a lifelong process that we will have to keep doing till, you know, as Swami would say, fight till the end, right? It is not fight for the end, but it is fight till the end. The end is fixed. We have to keep at it till that end comes, right? So all of these things are lifelong processes. At no point we can stop this. Why? Because the mind is still there, and the mind is the source of that rasa. As long as the mind is there, as long as that rasa is there in the mind, at any point it can spring back to life. With maturity, the mind knows that it cannot go after everything that it places its mind on. And to that certain extent, that disciplining happened. But once the vision of Brahman has been had, param drishtva, when the ultimate has been perceived, then the taste for such things itself goes away. Rasaha api nivartate, even the taste vanishes. Often this beautiful example is given, you know, there is this, the example of seeds. You know, you can bury seeds in the soil, and let's say there is no rain and you have not watered that particular part of the ground, and the seeds don't sprout because we have not provided it with nourishment. But Swami would say that, you know, years have gone by, or months or seasons have gone by, and suddenly there is a shower of rain, and suddenly you will find that the whole field springs back to life. And how you say that we have not put seeds? I don't remember putting seeds in the ground. But how did we have all of these things springing up? Because Swami would say the seeds were there long back. They did not receive the nourishment till that point. But now they found the nourishment, they have sprung to life. Right? Of course, the same example is even given about spiritual thoughts. Most of what we hear from Swami, or most of what we hear in our satsang or programs like this, or when we read, may not always express themselves in our life, but they are like seeds which go deep into our conscience, and at some suitable time and in suitable circumstances, they all spring to life. And that's the positive way of that analogy. But if you look at it from the negative point of view, the seeds are like those you know, those taste for such things which are buried deep in our mind, and because of disciplining we have ensured that they do not sprout, but they always run the risk of coming to life when the circumstances around them are suitable for them to sprout, right? So Swami would say that they are like seeds which are buried inside, anytime they can come to life. But Swami would say, take the same seeds and roast them in a pan, right? That's the example which is often given. Roast them in a pan, and now again you bury them in the ground, you give them gallons of water, you give them plenty of nourishment, put the best of manure and fertilizer and give it the best of sunlight. Will the seeds sprout again? Swami would say no, because you have completely removed the ability of that seed to sprout again. And it would be said that having that supreme vision is like roasting that seed. Not only will they not sprout now, but they lose their ability to sprout at all. Rasavarjam rasaha api nivartate. The cravings are gone, even the taste which is behind the craving is gone. So when Krishna defines the Sthita Prajna as someone who is a jnana nishta, right, that's a beautiful phrase which we often use in Vedanta. It comes many times. Jnana nishta means it's a rephrasing of the word Sthita Prajna. Jnana nishta means one who is firm in that jnana. So Sthita Prajna is a jnana nishta. He is firm in that knowledge. And what is the jnana? The jnana is the vision, that vision of the divine within, right? So he says, Tasya prajna pratishtita. Such a person's prajna or awareness or his wisdom is firmly fixed, right? Such a person does not have cravings in the mind and also loses the taste for the sense objects. So again, as we've been saying, that all of this is the ultimate description, right? He's giving, there are two things. So all of these descriptions give us a certain sense of what you and I can practice, but it also gives us a glimpse of the end of the road. When this is practiced, all of this becomes spontaneous. And how does it become spontaneous? How do cravings completely go? Because the one who has seen the ultimate will no more find taste in all of these small, small things. All of these things in life become insipid, right? And we see this in our everyday life. You know, we give up the kind of things that we craved for when we were children have very effortlessly gone away from our mind now, right? Because we've seen greater things, we've seen better things, and we have better things to occupy our life with. As somebody said, you know, I was obsessed with toys when I was a kid. Now I have bigger toys to be obsessed with, right? That's precisely what we all do. But when we talk of the ultimate, param drishtva, when you see the ultimate, every other craving just drops away because you've had the taste of the ultimate, right? But the process of getting there is through this disciplining process of withdrawing the indriyas from the objects of the senses. And what does that mean? It does not mean just stuffing my ear with cotton or closing my eyes or being in Maunam for eternity. It is about knowing when the senses have to be used and knowing when the inputs from the senses have to be completely ignored and discarded. So we'll have to conclude with that. I'm already running late. Thank you, dear listeners, for joining me. If you have anything to share, you can always write to us. You can write to us at listener@radiosai.org. That's our feedback mail. If you have any questions in what I've said, any clarifications, any references, feel free to write to me. I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Of course, now you can send us your feedback even through WhatsApp. Our WhatsApp number is 9393258258. So far, that's the fastest way your feedback can reach us. So if you're interested, you could use that. 9393258258. I'll join you all again next week for the continuation of the Gita series, The Triune Pilgrimage. Do join me. We are still in the second chapter. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the Vahini Satsang. They're going through the summary of the Vahini Satsang they've done so far. The Prem Vahini has just been concluded. So I'm going to leave it to Brother Bishu. I'll join you all again next week, 7:30 p.m. for the continuation of the Gita series. Till then, take care. Jai Sai Ram.
You are listening to Radio Sai Thursday Live. Stay tuned.